If you would, go ahead and get your outlines out. And we are on the PM side, obviously. In Exodus chapter 4, which is the beginning of our text this evening, we're actually going to cover quite a bit of Exodus. But in Exodus chapter 4, what we have is another instance, and it feels odd to discuss it like this, but as we were talking about last week, Moses is kind of like the special agent of God. And as he comes forward to do the will of God, just like every special agent, just like every individual in all those movies that we watch, he needs, you'd say, gadgets. He needs stuff to do his job. And just like every time they come to a table, right, and there's stuff laid out on the table, and they pick something up, and it's a pen, right? And he's like, well, great, thanks, a pen. And the person who designs it and creates these things, he says, that's not a pen, it's some kind of poison dart gun, or it takes video of things, and he's got a watch that's a laser, and it's all kinds of stuff that's just everyday stuff. It's not going to stand out in a crowd. There's nothing about him that, you know, he's got a rocket launcher strapped to his back or anything. I mean, it's everyday stuff that is useful in other ways. And the interesting thing is, again, God is the first one to come up with this kind of stuff. If you look here in Exodus chapter 4, starting in verse 1, he says, "Then Moses answered and said, but suppose they will not believe me or listen to my voice. Suppose they say the Lord has not appeared to you." And so God has given him charge to go not only to the elders, but ultimately to go to Pharaoh and the court of Pharaoh to speak to the people who are in the know in this situation, people with power over the Israelites. And he says that I'm going to, as we looked at last week, I'm going to give you some backup. Right? I'm going to be there with you, and you're going to take the elders with you. We'll see in just a moment, Aaron's going to go with him as well, and going to be his mouth in that way. I'm going to give you a badge, as we saw last week, and I am that I am. I'm going to give you my name, right? Who I am, to tell the Israelites, and to certify that the things that you say are from me. And he says, what if the people still won't listen? Which is a legitimate thing. As we'll see in just a few minutes, people are very hard of hearing in the sense that they don't want to hear, that they don't want to listen to what God has to say, so they give every reason why they don't have to. In verse 2 he says, so the Lord said to him, what is that in your hand? Hey Moses, what you got there? And Moses says, it's just a rod. It's just a stick. And literally, that's what he had. He had a stick. Probably a walking stick is the concept here. And he is using it to meander around the place that he's going. And God says, cast it on the ground. So he cast it on the ground and it became a serpent. And Moses fled from it. Then the Lord said to Moses, reach out your hand and take it by the tail. And he reached out his hand and caught it. And it became a rod in his hand. Now verse 5, that they may believe that the Lord God of their fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, has appeared to you. He says, I've given you this. You've been enabled to do this. I've given you this. It's just a rod. It's just a stick. It's nothing big. It's just an everyday thing. And God says, no, it's not. It's not. In fact, it's a tool for you to use. It's not just a staff now. It's not just a rod. It's a snake, he says. A snake that obeys Moses' command in that context. In verse 6, furthermore, the Lord said to him, put your hand in your bosom. And he put his hand in his bosom. And when he took it out, behold, his hand was leprous like snow. And he said, put your hand in your bosom again. So he put it in his hand in his bosom again and drew it out of his bosom. And behold, it was restored like his other flesh. So the staff is now gone, right? The rod is to the side. What do you got now, Moses? I got nothing, just my hands. And God says, all right, put your hand in your shirt pocket, you would say, in our context. Put it in your shirt, put it against your bosom. And when he brings it out, he now has leprosy. Well, that's not such a great trick in that context. Well, great, I've got leprosy on my hand now. But he's saying, God is saying to Moses, I'm giving you the ability to, right, put leprosy on others, it seems. But more importantly, he hasn't put his hand back in, and they're taking it away. I'm going to show you something, especially if you tie this in 2 Kings chapter 5. When Naaman goes and writes a letter to the king of Israel about his leprosy, about the leprosy that he possesses, and he has received word from one of his servants, who's an Israelite, that there is a man in Israel who can heal him of his leprosy. And he wants this man to heal him, so he sends a letter ahead to the king of Israel, thinking the king's obviously the boss of the prophet, which isn't really the case. And so this king receives this letter, he opens it up, and he says, Am I God that I can give life and take it? Is literally his words there in 2 Kings 5. Am I God that I can give life and take it? That is the degree to which leprosy was a danger to the people of the time. There was no cure for it outside of God. Outside of God blessing an individual and removing it. Though some individuals receive leprosy, and sometimes it's taken away shortly after. Sometimes they receive leprosy for the rest of their lives. In fact, Elijah's servant receives the leprosy that Naaman gets rid of. Gehazi, in fact, is his name there in 2 Kings chapter 5, because he is dishonest with Elisha. And so he says, I've just got my hand. It's just a rod. It's just my hand. And God's like, no, it's not. It's the ability to give and take life in that sense, not necessarily specifically, but to show, and the whole purpose behind these abilities is to show the work of God. And so he says, and when you get there, you're going to take some water. In verse 9, it shall be, if they do not believe even these two signs, or listen to your voice, that you shall take water from the river and pour it on the dry land. The water which you take from the river will become blood on the dry land. It's just some water from the river. And in Egypt, that's not a big deal at all. I mean, that's a pretty common thing. The water from the river, that's where their entire lives revolved around the Nile River. They received all their bounty from the river, the fish of the river. They received their daily portion of water from the river. They traveled up and down the river. All the reeds that grew on the river, some were used for various things. Papyrus was grown there. They were able to make paper because of it. Or papyrus, what we call paper. It's just some water from the river. No, no. Moses, when you pour it on the dry ground, it's going to turn into blood. Everyday things that people would not think a second thing about. And yet in the hands of a person who is supported by God, is required by God to do something, everyday things become special things. Everyday things become significant, important things. And that's what Moses has at his disposal, only because he is the one serving the Lord. In Exodus chapter 5 and verse 4, we see something that's very common in these types of spy movies or special agent movies. And that's that things tend to get worse before they get better. And brethren, that's the way our lives work. And people think that when they become a Christian, their life's going to turn into a cup of tea. It would be a bad thing if their life turned into a cup of tea, like their house turned into a cup of tea, and their car turned into a cup of tea. That's not really increasing value there. They think that their life's just going to be simple after this. That it's going to be uncomplicated, sure. It doesn't mean it's easy. It gets hard sometimes doing the will of God. It becomes difficult to stand in the face of the world when the world wants you to do their thing. That's not easy at all. And so here in Exodus chapter 5, the people start, hey, you know, this guy Moses, he's got something going on here. And maybe he is a servant of God. Maybe we should follow him. And when Moses goes to the king of Egypt, it says in verse 4, he says to them, Moses and Aaron, why do you take the people from their work, go back to your labor? You've riled these people up, they think they're going out to worship God at that mountain you're talking about. And why are you riling them up? Why are you getting them distracted from them? They've got stuff to do, Moses. So Pharaoh said, look, the people of the land are many now, and you make them rest from their labors. You're taking away their work. Stop it, Moses. So the same day, verse 6, Pharaoh commanded the taskmasters of the people and their officers, saying, you shall no longer give the people straw to make brick as before. Let them go and gather straw for themselves, and you shall lay on them the quota of bricks which they made before. You shall not reduce it, for they are, there's that word, idle. Therefore they cry out, saying, let us go and sacrifice to our God. He says, they've got time to think about God. They've got time to think about going and worshiping God. They think they've got time to go and worship God. That must mean they've got more time to work. That means that I don't have to give them straw now, and I can maintain the responsibility, the quota, he says, on these individuals. And I'm going to require that they continue doing the things that they were supposed to do. He says, verse 9, let more work be laid on the men, that they may labor in it, and let them not regard false words. And the taskmasters of the people and their officers went out and spoke to the people, saying, thus says Pharaoh, I will not give you straw. Go get yourselves straw where you can find it, yet none of your work will be reduced. Not a single ounce, not a single portion, not a single brick is going to be missing. You are going to keep up exactly how you've always kept up, because you are obviously not doing as much work as you could, in verse 15. Then the officers of the children of Israel came and cried out to Pharaoh, saying, "Why are you dealing thus with your servants? There is no straw given to your servants, and they say to us, 'Make brick.' And indeed your servants are beaten, but the fault is in your own people." But he said, "You are idle." "Idle," he says. "Therefore they say, 'Let us go and sacrifice to the Lord.' Therefore go now and work, for no straw shall be given you, yet you shall deliver the quota of bricks." And the officers of the children of Israel saw that they were in trouble after it, and said, "You shall not reduce any bricks from your daily quota." Now notice how they respond, verses 20 and 21. "Then as they came out from Pharaoh, they met Moses and Aaron, who stood there to meet them." What do you think 21 is going to say? "And they rejoiced with Moses and Aaron that these things took place. And they were glad that Pharaoh was angry with them." Oh, they really were committed to going out and worshiping God at the mountain that Moses had. No, that's not what 21 says. In fact, it says, "And they said to them, 'Let the Lord look on you and judge, because you have made us abhorrent in the sight of Pharaoh and in the sight of his servants, to put a sword in their hand to kill us.'" He says, "You put this brilliant idea in our heads and you got us riled up. It's all your fault." And God, he says, they say as a whole, "will judge you over these things." Doesn't sound like they're very happy with Moses and Aaron. And they suspect, though they'd be wrong, that it is not God behind these things, that they're riling these individuals up. They're riling the people of Israel up in order to hurt them, to cause them grief. It gets worse before it gets better, friends. And that seems to be the point that Moses and Aaron is trying to make with them. And so they blame Moses and Aaron. Isn't that the way of things? In these movies, when the bad guy threatens to hurt people, unless this person gives themselves up, it's the guys... You're going to trust the bad guys? Are you kidding me? It's the good guy's fault that the bad guy is evil? No, the good guy is supposed to be the good guy. He's supposed to do the right thing regardless of the situation. And yes, sometimes people suffer because it gets worse in most cases before it gets better. And you've got to do the hard part before you reap the rewards of the difficulty and the disadvantage that you might take. Jesus on the cross. He prayed in the garden that this cup would pass from him. In the garden, he hasn't suffered yet in that context. And yet he knows it's going to get worse before it gets better. He knows that God is going to glorify him. That's the very thing he prays for in John chapter 17. That God is going to glorify him after these things take place. But he has to endure it. He has to go through these things. He has to ultimately die on the cross, being tormented and persecuted by these people. Because it's going to get worse before it gets better. Our lives here on this earth, if we are a child of God, they're going to get worse before they get better. Because we're going to be an enemy of the world in order to be a friend of God. And the world's going to hate us just as it hated them. Just as it hated Jesus. In 2 Timothy chapter 4, Paul speaking concerning the things that he is looking forward to, admits that there are problems that come regardless of the ultimate goal you're looking for. He says, "For I am already being poured out as a drink offering, and the time of my departure is at hand." That sounds like a really good thing. Paul's saying, it's almost time for me to go. It doesn't sound in verse 7. He says, "I have fought the good fight, I have finished the race, I have kept the faith. Finally there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will give to me on that day, and not to me only, but also to all who have loved his appearing." Now if you didn't have verse 6, it would sound really nice. I am really looking forward to that place in heaven, but what does verse 6 say? My departure is at hand. I am being poured out as a drink offering. That's not a pleasant thing, friends. And Paul's sitting in prison right now. Cold, if you continue on when he asks Timothy to bring him his coat. Right? He's got things that need done, even though he's about to die, in Paul's understanding of things. And things aren't going so well for Paul right now, and yet he can still look forward to something, though he knows that in order to receive that thing, there's some bad stuff that's got to happen in between. And yet that's not what we want to talk about. That's not what we want to think about. We want to think about all the good things. Well, that's good. But you've got to accept the bad with the good. You've got to understand that it's going to get worse before it gets better. that your life's not going to be that cup of tea all the time. But it will. It will get better in the Lord. In Exodus chapter 7, we go back to this kind of what you got there, Moses concept. Only this time, it's not so much the what do you have there, Moses. God, it seems, in a lot of ways, kind of looking around. Well, what do I have at my disposal? Well, I've got the water of the Nile, which is really important to the people of Egypt. And I already turned water into blood just a little bit ago, back in chapter 4. Or at least said he would turn water into blood back in chapter 4. And you know, a little bit of some of these bad things is manageable. I mean, most of us, you know, we dealt with frogs in our home. We've dealt with lice. If you've had kids, it drives you nuts. You know, if you might have had cattle that occasionally has gotten sick or diseased. You know, hail falls from the sky, dents your car. That's not such a fun thing. Locusts and darkness. And the power goes out like it did a couple of years ago for an extended period of time. But that's not what we're talking about here, is it? From chapter 7 and chapter 10, we have some of the nastiest things taking place. A little bit is manageable, but the quantity, the overwhelmingness of these plagues makes them exactly that, plagues. It becomes a really bad thing. A little water turning to blood is not such a big deal, but the entire river, as we said just a moment ago, the entire ecosystem of Egypt relied on that river. Transportation, water to drink, the creatures of the water were used for food regularly, the crops that were in the water were regularly used for food, and not only that, but it irrigated all of their crops, even inland. And so it was a huge, devastating issue for the Egyptians because God had turned this water into blood. But if you read there in chapter 7, it's not just at a random happenstance. It's when the Pharaoh, or the king of Egypt, is traveling as he does every day to that part of the river. And Aaron brings his rod out and he smacks the water, turns to blood. In open defiance of the Pharaoh, of the king of Egypt, Aaron, Moses, ultimately God. You're going to give credit and put it where it's due, I suppose. God turns the water of the Nile into blood. That is a huge deal to the Egyptians. A couple of frogs here and there is kind of nuisance. Sometimes it's good. Some people like them to eat them and keep them as pets. But frogs being in an overwhelming number to where they are everywhere. And at the end of the plague, notice when they all die and they pile it, they don't just disappear. Right, it's not like these crazy stories they come up with where they just, you know, all these plagues, they just disappear. You know? The frogs are just suddenly gone. No big deal. No, they're a bunch of dead frogs. So they pile them up and it smells horrible for a long time. Yeah, make